Deep in the mountains, you have to use what you have on hand and make do with whatever you can find or grow. And this applies to everything, including warding your home against the bad kinds of haints and working with magic. Our guest today knew she would inherit certain gifts because her mother told her she would, just as her mother before her had. She learned to work with the energy of the land, to help others with their ghost issues, and to become her community's village witch. Let's hear her stories today on Homespun Haints. Hainted loves, we have a quick little disclaimer to make before we air this episode. In the bit you are about to hear, we refer to the fish as largemouth bass, when in fact they are rainbowless rainbow trout. We apologize for the error. Hello, Hainted Loves. Welcome to Homespun Haints. I'm Becky.
And I'm Diana.
And today on the show, we are delighted to bring on yet another person who has some stories to tell us from Appalachia, because that's our focus today. We are going to be bringing on an author, and you guys are going to love her stories, because not only is she a well-written author with many books under her name, she is also known as the Asheville Village Witch.
And
Asheville, North Carolina, which, as you know, is nestled in the Blue Ridge Mountains of the Appalachians.
Indeed.
So we're bringing on H. Byron Ballard. She is the author of the book Small Magics. She is going to share with you a lot of her knowledge that she has also poured forth in this book. But she's also going to tell us some ghost stories.
There is so much I learned from this interview. I can't wait. I'm really excited to share it with everybody.
Yes, it's a fabulous interview. And it has inspired us, among other things, to actually go visit Asheville.
Indeed. That will be part of our Appalachian Grand Tour.
That's right. We have hinted at it, but it is solidified. Diana's coming to Atlanta. And then from Atlanta, we are driving. We're driving into the deep, dark mountains, and we're going to be visiting some of the people that you've heard on this show.
We are.
And we're going to be hanging out in some haunted locations that we've talked about on this show. But I'm not going to say any more than that until our itinerary is solidified. I am so excited. One of the places that we're going to be hitting up, I will tell you this because I don't have to arrange anything ahead of time, but one place I really, really want to take you to, Diana, just because it's so weird. Mm-hmm. It's weird and it's creepy in an elemental kind of way.
Ooh, sounds like my bag.
Uh-huh. It's the Lost Sea.
Wait, there's a sea in Appalachia?
Up until recently, it was believed to be the largest underground sea in the world.
When I was in the Ozark Mountains in Branson, we visited an underground lake, sea, hell mouth, not certain exactly. Okay. The Devil's Pool.
Oh, that's right. Yeah, mm-hmm. Yeah. Okay.
We talked about that.
Yeah, we did. Well, this is, I bet you anything, creepier.
Well, it's in Appalachia, so obviously.
It is technically a lake, even though it's called the Lost Sea. It is now the world's second largest non-subglacial. So it's not under a glacier, underground lake.
It's been a long time since the Appalachians were under a glacier.
I've been here, and it's truly a terrifying experience for so many reasons. It is part of this network of caverns known as the Craighead Caverns, which are named after Chief Craighead, who owned them at the time that they were put on a cartographer's map or something. It's a really cool set of caves. As you know, there's a lot of caves under Appalachia. Well, in 1904, there was a little boy named Ben. And Ben liked to play in the caves, because back then, and now, we let our kids run around in caves unsupervised in Appalachia, because that's safe.
As you should. I mean, there's tons of caves there. That just feels normal.
He found a little opening, and he squirmed his way in, and he held up his little lantern, because, you know, it's before flashlights. It's 1904, folks, so he has his little, like, fire in his little lantern. He's holding it up, and he can't see any walls in this cave. It's so dark and it's so big. there was mud on the floor. So he grabbed these balls of mud and he started throwing them to try and hear where they hit the walls to find out how big it was. And all he heard were splashes. Of course, little Ben's all excited. He goes back out. He goes to his dad. He's like, "Dad, Dad, I found an underground sea." Dad's like, "Whatever, kid." He's like, "No, Dad, really, really, I did." Dad doesn't believe him. Dad doesn't believe him at all. Well, finally, he convinces his father to come back and check out the cave.
What was it?
Well, by then, the water level had risen so high in other parts of the caves that they couldn't get to the entrance. They couldn't go in.
Oh.
So it was just kind of forgotten about. A few years later, some actual explorers found it, and Ben was like, "See, I told you so."
Nobody's an actual explorer like little kids.
Yes. So he does get the credit for discovering it.
Go, Ben. Please, please don't tell me he haunts the cave now.
No.
Oh, good.
I hope not. Now, let me tell you a little bit more about this lake, this underground lake. The part that you can see when it's like at normal height, because the height of the water does ebb and flow with drought and heavy rains. So water's coming in from somewhere. I just don't know where. Or is it a tide? No. Oh. Anyway, it's about 800 feet long by 220 feet wide. That comes to about 4.5 acres.
That's quite an underground lake.
4.5 acres is about how big this lake is that you can see.
Oh.
And people have gone down and tried to explore and find out where it comes from, right? And they found these entire rooms, underwater rooms, and they can't find the edge. Like they don't know how far they go.
so we know that we can see the part that's 800 by 200, but we can't actually see all the way to the edge.
Yeah, nobody knows where it ends, where it comes from. And when you go to visit this cave, you wander through the cave for a while and you come to the edge of the lake. They've opened it up now. You don't have to crawl through that little cranny anymore. They've actually opened it up so tourists can come. They have docks out there and boats and everything. And you can get on the boat and they'll take you out on the lake. Now, here's where it really gets creepy.
Uh-oh.
It is pitch black. All you hear is the sound of the oars into the water and the echoes of those oars on the cavern ceilings. But you really can't see anything else. The water is green from the light of the flashlights, and then it just disappears. Then they tell you, if something falls overboard, it stays overboard. And you're just in this tiny little canoe out in this endless sea, in a cave. And then the guide says to you, "Oh, it's feeding time." And he pulls some fish food from a little pouch and he pours it into the lake. And a whole school of wide-mouthed bass come to eat the food. And they disappear again. And he goes around and he feeds some more. And the fish come up and go away. You see, in the 70s, when they were trying to figure out where the lake came from, they put some bass in the lake and tagged them so that they could follow where they went. Are you tired of websites that have been Frankenstein together?
Oh, my website is so slow and creaky.
Every time I use the search bar, it just returns Abby Normal over and over again.
Becky's sister company, The Concept Spot, holds the secret to life itself and can create new life from nothing. In fact, we've been giving life to highly functional websites for the last 25 years using premium parts we swear we didn't salvage from graveyards.
Ooh, check out that head. character image. Instead of going, my new website purrs.
Need a blog? The Concept Spot can do that. Want an online store? We can do that too.
We build our sites from the cellular level. No reused templates or discarded body parts here, so we can make your site do whatever you want and look however you want.
It's gorgeous! I can't even see the stitches.
We can also resurrect your dead website if rigor mortis has set in.
Oh, it's like a new man.
If you think Homespun Haints is frighteningly genius, you should see our websites. Let your favorite ghoulish gals, Becky and Diana, build you a monstrous website that will wreak havoc on the internet for years to come.
Visit theconceptspot.com for more information.
It's live! It's live!
Oh, okay. That's clever, because if bass end up in some other body of water, they'll know where the water comes from. Sure, okay.
The problem is, the bass never left.
Why would they? They keep going back and feeding them.
They have to, because there's nothing else for the bass to eat. There's absolutely nothing in this water but the fish that they put in it and their progeny.
Oh.
Isn't that weird? No natural ecosystem. All that exists in this lake are the fish that they put there. And now they have to feed them. Because somebody's got to feed the fish. There's no plankton. There's no little fish. There's nothing else. Yeah, I don't even know what the bacterial content is, honestly.
Right. Was the water sterile or was it so toxic?
It was pretty sterile.
Huh. Before you put bass in it.
Yeah, I wouldn't drink it now, but
yeah.
I mean, you shouldn't ever drink water anyway, because even if it's quote unquote sterile, it might have like lead in it.
True.
Just because there's no bacteria doesn't mean there's not shit in it that can kill you. I think this is one of the creepiest places on Earth, and I can't wait to take you there, Diana.
We get to go there?
Of course we get to go there. Why do you think I'm talking about it?
I'm so excited. What are we going to do? We need to bring some of this water with us home.
No. You can do that. I'm not going to.
It's too haunted.
Yeah. I just think there's something something otherworldly about that water. I don't want to have anything to do with it. Yeah. I think it comes from a portal into another world. And the bass are like, nope. Not today, Satan. We'll stay right here in our pitch black lake with no source of food.
Yeah. Obviously, much better option than going through the portal. But the bass prefer the devil they know.
Anyway.
That's terrifying.
Yeah. I'm so excited. Now, if you get close to this, you'll see signs for it everywhere. It's kind of like Sea Rock City. It is not an unknown place in the area.
So it's not one of those little hole in the walls where you might disappear and never be seen again. It might.
Just don't fall in the lake.
What if I fall in the lake?
Don't. You can swim, right?
In normal water, yes, but in cursed water, I don't know.
Okay, don't fall in the lake. Easy peasy. You're flying in. Just bring the seat cushion with you when you get off the plane. I'm going to need this for later.
You said it was my flotation device in the announcement video.
I paid for the seat, damn it. Don't I get to take it with me?
It's mine. I'm taking it. There you go. Just like their headphones and their blankets.
Well, anyway, y'all stay tuned. We'll live stream as much as we can with it and definitely share posts. And we're going to be putting a lot of stuff on our Patreon as we go on this trip.
And if you're going to be in Appalachia, of course, it's a very large place. But if you happen to be near Asheville, we're going to be traveling all over visiting haunted locations and talking to haunted people.
Be sure you follow us on our Patreon to find out more about it if you're not in Appalachia, so you can see what we do. That's at patreon.com/homespunhaints.
And one other thing, if you join our Patreon, you wouldn't be listening to this commercial.
Today on the show, we are thrilled to bring on Byron Ballard. She is another wonderful author. Her most recent book, Small Magics, Practical Secrets from an Appalachian Village Witch, is available from Llewellyn Press. She's also written a number of other books, and she's got more in the works ahead. She is known as the Village Witch of Asheville. That gives you a clue right there, a little bit about her and where she lives. If you're not familiar with Asheville, it's located in western North Carolina, which is in the Blue Ridge Mountains of the Appalachians. It's a gorgeous, gorgeous part of the country that is incredibly haunted. In fact, our very first episode on this show was me relaying a story of my son seeing a ghost in a haunted bed and breakfast in Hendersonville, just outside of Asheville.
Oh, that's right.
We're very familiar with the ghosts there. I love Asheville. It is an absolutely wonderful town. If you've never been there, you must go there at some point in your life. Byron, thank you so much for being here on the show. It's wonderful to talk to you.
Welcome.
It is my pleasure, and we got a lot to talk about today, because there's a lot of haints up in here.
Absolutely. So tell us about what you do. You write books, you write a column for a local magazine, you've been in anthologies, you're also involved in the community there in Asheville. So give us a little bit of backstory.
Well, I'm going to start with the community piece, because that's a piece that's most important to me. When I travel, because I do a lot of festivals and conferences, and people go, oh, you are so lucky to live in Asheville. It's got such a vibrant pagan community. And I go, listen up. We have a vibrant pagan community because we built this community brick by brick over 25 years. And before that, we made the bricks. So if you think you would like to have a vibrant pagan community, you just have to commit to doing that, and you have to do the work, and you have to take the knocks, and you got to take the people writing letters to the editor of the paper about the road to hell and how I am the signpost for that. And you just got to be tough-skinned. And frankly, you got to be as tough-skinned about your religious community as you are about the rest of the community, because as y'all well know, the pagan community spends almost all of its time fighting among itself. Mm,
yeah.
So, yes, it is a vibrant community. And I was born and raised in West, by God, Buncombe County. I still think of myself as a rural person, though I've lived in Asheville most of my whole life. I practice a kind of Appalachian folk magic. And I'm always countering the idea that it's called Appalachian granny magic, because it's not. It's not called anything at all. For one thing, it's not called magic because it comes down through a completely Protestant filter. I mean, my Methodist family used the word witch, but they never used the word magic. And a whole lot of Baptists and Pentecostals are not comfortable even with the word witch. Mm-hmm. So I talk a lot about that. I talk about how Appalachian Granny Magic was a brand that publishers put out. And now it's a hot commodity. Everybody wants to know all about it. And there are people, actually not even in this country, who go, oh, I just love the idea of Appalachian Granny Magic and I want to learn all about it. Which is fortunate for me because I'm a writer and I want them to buy all my books. But it's not so fortunate in that this is a practice based in the land here. It's based in the soil. And if you have ancestors from here, you have a kind of connection. But if you're not on this land, the connection is not so strong, to be honest. So that's what I do. I farm, garden. I am one of the founders and the senior priestess at Mother Grove Goddess Temple. And I write books, and I go into people's houses to deal with their haints, which most of the time is not really a haint. Most of the time, it's the person who called me who really needs psychiatric meds.
Oh, that's got to be an interesting balance to try and walk.
Well, I developed this thing years ago called the energy trap. And I will send you all a photograph of that, okay, so you can see. But it's really simple. You cut out the bottom of an aluminum pie pan, and you got a flat circle. And in the middle of that, you put a dark rock from your property and a tea light candle. And around that rock or those rocks, you put heavy salt, like ice cream salt. And on the outside edge, you put regular table salt. And I cannot tell you why it does what it does. But it's a HEPA filter for energy. The energy comes in through the light, through either the candle or the electric light. It is filtered first through the dark rocks, filtered a second time through the heavy salt, and filtered the third time through the light salt, and then it's reflected back out.
Wow.
So the first thing I do is send a picture and instructions. When somebody wants me to drive 2.5 hours to check out that weird feeling in their house, first I say, do this and see how the energy feels. Because honestly, 75% of the time, they go, oh, that solved the problem. And it was just the way our houses are built. We bring energy into the house when we go. And it moves around a little bit, but it kind of gets bunged up in the corners.
Yep.
Mm-hmm.
And if you haven't done anything to clear the energy in the house in a while, it starts to feel like that bouncy, stagnant energy is something. It's an entity of some kind. When really, you just need to get in there maybe with a broom or a wooden spoon or whatever and kind of get the energy stirred up again, and you're probably going to be fine. So that's the first thing I always do when I'm called about. I'm pretty sure there's a fill in the blank. It's a poltergeist. It's an old woman. It's always a Confederate soldier. It's a Confederate soldier. Yeah. Haunting the house.
Sorry.
Of course it is.
I mean, of course it is. I mean, we were part of the Confederacy, no question, but we had one battle here really late in the war, so there's not a lot of Confederate dead here. Sorry.
Right. Sorry.
That's how I got to be the village witch, because I do all that village witch stuff.
Mm-hmm.
I bless babies and I bless new houses and people moving into a house that's new to them but not new. And I show people how to ward their property lines. And so I do all of that kind of village witch stuff.
What is your best haint encounter story?
Oh, I have so many, but I want to tell you a sweet one.
Aw.
So a fellow about 2 streets over from me contacted me, and he said, the woman who used to live in this house is still here, and would you come over? I went over there and I walked through the house, and I would be able to say to him, oh, this passage right here is cold, so I'm assuming, does she walk through here? Yes, she does. And I went into a room and I put my hand on the door and said, now, was this her room? And he said, yes, it was. So we went through the whole house like that, blah, blah, blah. And we came back down to the kitchen, and we were sitting in his kitchen having coffee. And he was telling me how every morning he could hear her coming down the stairs. And even though he didn't see the chair move, he could hear the chair scrape back from the table. And so he would say, oh, good morning to her, and he knew her name. He lived alone, so he would say, oh, and today I'm just going to be home all day. I'm going to do some laundry and what. So he had this really beautiful kind of relationship with the previous owner. The stories were lovely and sweet, and she was never standing at the bottom of his bed, terrifying him at midnight. She was just a spirit that was still home. We finished up, and I said, well, what do you want me to do about her? And he said, do? I don't want you to do anything about her. This is her house. I'm just renting. And as long as she's here, she's here. And I just thought that was so touching and beautiful. And it is particularly Southern and Appalachian.
Yeah.
Because we tend to, rather than say, oh my God, Uncle Fred is still in the attic. What are we going to do? We will say, okay, so you're spending the night at my house. If you hear some bumping around in the attic, it is either a raccoon that's got in or it's Uncle Fred who died in 1947 and he just still stays in the attic. We are companionable, I think, about most of our haints. You know, we were talking earlier about when I get a phone call about there's something in my house. One of my very first questions is always about, tell me about the teenagers who live there. Because teenagers and women in general, we hold on to this bundled fury, and there's really no place we can put it. And sometimes for young people, that ends up being these terrible things like cutting and suicidal ideation and all of that. And for women, then we get fibromyalgia and ulcers and all that other stuff, because there's no place to put the fury of the condition of your life. So often when somebody says, oh, there's a poltergeist and we've seen things fly across the room and things disappear, and then I will say, so do you have children, or are you yourself a menopausal woman? And sometimes talking through what I just said to y'all really gives them a place where they can focus. Because in a way, it's easier to think there is a malignant spirit in my house rather than my life is lived in a situation where I am abused, in a situation where I'm not believed to be worthy by the people with whom I cohabitate. I'm a pastor, too, so I do that kind of counseling. But, you know, sometimes there's something in the house, and then I go out there and I take care of it. I grew up with a lot of ghosts. My parents moved after my father got back from the Army. They moved out to West Buncombe County, where I came from, into this little, it was evidently like a little dollhouse of a house with a beautiful garden and an apple orchard. It was just lovely. And the man who sold it to them, his name was Mr. Haney. He and his wife had moved in with one of their children who lived just down the cove. So almost every day, Mr. Haney would come up to make sure the house was okay and to say hello to my mother, who did not work outside the home. She would hear him come up the steps because he was kind of old and wheezy. And at the top of the steps, he'd have to stop. And she would hear him strike an old-fashioned match. And he'd light a cigarette. And then he'd come around to the door of the house and he'd peck on the door. And then she would come and let him in. Well, that continued long after Mr. Haney had died. My mother would hear him coughing up the steps. She would smell the cigarette smoke. But Mr. Haney, I mean, they had gone to his funeral. Mr. Haney was dead. We lived with that, with my mother talking about that. Now, I never experienced that. My gift is not the gift of being able to discern, talk to, communicate, and usually see spirits. I can only feel them. Occasionally I do see them, but mostly I sense them and work with them that way. But my daughter got the same thing that my mother had. She got that same gift of spirits all around her. And she would say things, she still says things to me when she's at home. She'll say things like, there's somebody walking behind you. And I'll go, tell me what they look like. And she'll describe them, and then I'll turn in the direction that they are, and I'll say, will you ask them if there's anything I can do for them? And she almost always responds with, no, they're just wandering, just lonely, just want to hang out with the family. And that's something that's been with her whole life.
And it doesn't scare her?
No, because the way our family is, we, the women anyway, are told from an early age, when you become a woman, when you start menstruating, you will receive one of these gifts. And that's one of them. The gift that I got initially was prophetic dreaming, precognitive dreaming. Hands-on healing is one of them. All kinds of wart removal, all that kind of second sight. My grandmother also had that. So that we are ready. So once you learn how to use a pad and a tampon, and you're ready for the big event, the other thing you are also getting ready for is whatever that thing is. So I told her that from the time she was about 9 or 10 years old on, that that would happen. And it did happen for her.
It makes such a difference being raised with that expectation and acceptance and being enveloped in a loving, protective family with that knowledge that you're going to experience this.
Are you a huge cunt?
Us too.
Wait, can we even say cunt?
Of course. It's empowering these days. Cunt, 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 cunt. I'm Ange Balasone, a.k.a. the drag queen, Fat Girl Gina.
And I'm Mike Fails, just a normal gay guy, I guess?
And we're the hosts of The Big Cunty Couch.
A gorgeous new talk show podcast where we invite queers and peers to sit bitch and be fierce on a huge-ass couch.
While we gab about all things gay.
So come get cozy.
And cunty.
With us. We're pan for platforms, so find us anywhere online and get listening, sweetie.
Or watching.
Or both.
Otherwise, why the hell am I in full drag?
And we'll see you on The Big Oh, wait. I thought we were going to say that together.
No. On the big cunty couch. Mwah.
Yeah. Yeah. And the understanding that it's special, but it's not frightening.
Right. Why do you think it happens at Menarche?
I don't know. I think that girls at that point are the most discerning that we will ever be again. we are the sharpest. And I think it's biologically driven. At the point where you can produce young, you have to know who's a danger to your young.
Oh, yeah.
And I think that's why we have the whole mean girl thing in middle school. Because we don't tell 10-year-olds, okay, when you start bleeding, when your menstrual cycle starts, you are going to be like a laser. And if somebody feels like they're the least little bit of a threat to you, you're going to put up all kinds of walls. You're going to be mad. You're going to be sensing danger. And I think it's all biological. But we never talk about that. We just say, oh, those mean girls, you know how they are. But I think there's a reason for that. I think it's a powerful time, both the oncoming of menses and the cessation of menses. You had mentioned earlier, I write a croning column for Sage Woman magazine, because there are all these women who are 40 plus, and nobody has ever talked to them about what's going to happen when menstruation ceases. If you're lucky, you've read a book about physically what's going to happen, but we don't talk about it. But now we have this huge number of women. We also have the platforms that are social media to say, I don't know what the hell's going on with my body. And then you go, well, when was your last period? Can you sleep at night? Do you have rage incidents? Yeah. So both of those places are incredibly bouncy, I guess.
So periods of hormonal change, puberty, pregnancy, menopause, mm-hmm. basically.
Is that why traditionally people associate having these gifts with being female? I do hear stories of male witches from Appalachia. I know that there have been stories, but it's not prevalent by any means.
When I was coming up, the only kind of witchery men did was water witching. They did dowsing to find articles, or water was the usual thing. If you think about women having no real power, like political, cultural power, but the thing that had been passed down to them was the use of herbs and incantations and prayers and all of that. That was something that men didn't need to know, because they were going to be working 12 hours a day, either in a factory, a mill, or on the land. That was something that women generally kept. Now there are all kinds of men who are Appalachian witches. Who am I to contradict that? I mean, it goes back to the other thing. Do you practice witchcraft? Because if you do, then you can use that word. And if you don't, if it's just branding so that you can sell yet another candle, then maybe not. So, yes, some of it was done by men, but they often, I mean, almost nobody used the word witch. We talk about the cunning man tradition that came out of the British Isles, and especially in the Low Country, they call themselves doctors. And in fact, up here, people were called cove doctors and yarb women. That was much more common than the word witch. But it was almost always about women's stuff. It's like, who's going to walk you through the pregnancy? Who's going to help you get pregnant? Who is going to keep you from getting pregnant again when you already have 6 children? Who's going to clean up the body once the death has happened? Who's going to do the dirty work? And frankly, in most cultures, the dirty work is done by women.
Yep. Thank you for walking through that and clarifying that. So one thing you mentioned a few minutes ago, you said that you usually sense the ghosts and things, you don't see them except occasionally. You kind of dropped that nugget that you have seen one or two.
A woman called me out here in Buncombe County, called me out because she wanted to have a big old Halloween party, but she felt sure, and she had been told that on her farm there was, you know, the ubiquitous Confederate soldier, and she wanted to be able to figure out where he was so she could rope that off, so the partygoers would not be in the area to disturb. And to her credit, she didn't want the ghost disturbed. It wasn't about anything other than that. I'm really good at the sensing energy and the hot and cold stuff. That's my best thing. So we're doing that, and I said, okay, here's the path. Here's the cold line. So if you kind of rope off this much, I don't think you'll have any problem. And plus, if the spirit makes some sort of appearance, then you can make sure your party people are quiet, but stand on the outside and just keep a watch, just in case. Because how cool would that be to have a big Halloween party? You go, oh, but if you're real quiet and go over there, you might be able to see the ghost. I mean, yeah, I get that. So we had done all that, and then we were standing in front of the barn, and it was one of those old, it was probably built in the 20s barns, and it was two stories, so the floor above was where the hayloft went. And there was a big door in the top with a pulley, because you would winch the hay up, baled hay, and put it into the hayloft. It was open because she didn't really farm the land. She just lived on the land. So we're standing there, and it's a beautiful spring day, and we're just looking around and looking at all the flowers and chatting. And I glanced back, and there was somebody standing in that doorway into the hayloft. It was a youngish girl, maybe mid to late teens, and she was in a plain blue, maybe patterned dress. I couldn't see it clear enough to tell you, but it could have been like a little pale blue dress with little flowers on it, something like that. And she was standing, leaning against the back of the doorway, and she was looking out towards town. And from that point up on the hill, you could see where the road went. And she moved, so she wasn't just frozen. She moved, and she would stretch, and she would turn her head and look towards the house. And I poked the woman, and I said, do you see that? And she turned around, and she said, what? And so this being was completely unaware of us. She was like an imprint that had been doing that. Our guess was, given how she was dressed, that she was probably waiting for her sweetheart to come home from World War II. And from the top of the barn, she could see farther down the road from when he would come. And after a while, she gave up standing, and she kind of slid down the jamb of the door and just sat there for a while. And then she slowly faded out. So when I say I don't often see them, occasionally I do see them. And when I do, it feels profound. It feels like I don't have the details. I just get to look in on somebody else's existence who is frankly not existing anymore. And it's fascinating, and it seemed very sad and sweet. We sort of had the story of he never came home. So she kept doing that again and again, and he just never came home. And then did she do something? Did she decide to go join him in the afterlife? I mean, we don't know. We don't know the story.
What was the energy like when you were observing this? I mean, you said that you mostly feel energy.
Yeah, it was sweet and a little sad. Sweet and a little sad. It was a good encounter. I still recall it. And that's been probably 25 years ago that happened. The ghost that I grew up with lived just down the hill from the cove where I was raised. And the story about her was horrific. In the back of my book, Roots, Branches, and Spirits, which is also from Llewellyn, and is all about really more traditional Appalachian craft, I have some ghost stories. And one of them is about this woman who, she and her husband fought all the time, all the time. And he ended up stabbing her. And at certain points at dusk, you could see her body, because she crawled out of the house onto the porch, and you could see the outline of her body on the porch, and they couldn't get rid of the blood stains, so they ended up covering the entire house with river rock. So that was one that I actually knew the story. We didn't know the people, because it had happened before I was born. I have driven past there since then, at sundown, I guess, but I haven't seen her since. You know, the thing about ghosts, I think sometimes they fade away and they never come back. Sometimes whatever it was that was imprinted on the soul of the place, it just fades finally at last.
The woman that you mentioned on the porch, that was in the house that you grew up in?
Oh, no. That was near where I grew up. I walked past there a lot as a kid. There was a little store down the hill from there, and we would walk down there to get candy and to buy my mother cigarettes back in the day when kids bought their mom's cigarettes for a quarter. But that was fascinating. And I grew up on stories of the man who was sleeping on the landing in the house where my grandmother was born, which I live in that same neighborhood now, but the house is gone. both my mother and my grandmother and my great uncles would talk about at certain times when the moon was right and the street light was right, you could see his shape just sleeping on like a settee. You couldn't see the settee. You could just see him sleeping on there. And she rented out rooms sometimes. She was very poor and ran a little grocery store. And she would rent out the occasional room once her children had started moving out. I made up the story that he was a salesman from Opelika, Alabama, just because I love to say Opelika, Alabama, and that he always got a room from her when he was in town, and that he died. He laid down on the settee to just rest, and he died there.
That's cool.
But I love him. I'm a big Hank fan.
See, this is another thing about growing up in this area that I found so fascinating when I left. I moved to Chicago when I was 17. And I realized that children in other parts of the country or other parts of the world don't necessarily grow up with these horrific stories and ghost stories and things like that. So when you try telling a group of 5 or 6 year olds a story of a horrendous murder and then the ghost that you might see afterward, their parents get upset with you. Unlike
Oh, the Midwest.
But when I was a kid, that was just standard fare. When I was 10, we built our own house. My parents saved and saved and saved, and they wanted to build their dream house. So we bought a little piece of land on a mountain, and they built their own house. And before we moved in, my mother said to me, "What if the new place is haunted?" I'm 10 years old. She's like, "I'm going to scare her." And I said, "Well, Mom, it's a brand new house." Because this is my child brain logic. I'm like, "It's a brand new house. There's not going to be any ghosts there." And she's like, "Oh, you know, that's not true. There could be, you know," talking about the ubiquitous Cherokee burial ground on the land. And we're going to be disturbing it when we break rock. And sure enough, that damn house was haunted. I don't know if she brought it with her or what, but that brand new construction house was haunted, and she loved that sort of thing. She loved telling me ghost stories, these stories of murder and moonshiners. It's not something that I've encountered outside of that area, and it's a shame. Children can handle it.
Oh, yeah. In fact, I think it's probably healthier for kids than to get introduced to when you're like 17.
Yeah.
Oh, we're going to go over and we're going to see the scary graveyard. And it's like, whatever. We got a ghost in the house.
Right.
So for a couple of years, I did a ghost tour of Asheville.
Nice.
And I took 13 people and they had to pay me $13. But we had an experience, you might remember the S&W cafeteria building downtown, and we were standing looking into that building, and I had my back to the building and was facing this little group and talking about how the ghost most frequently seen there was an African-American man in a white coat with a white tie, and he was carrying a big tray and coming carefully down the steps. I talked about segregation, and it was like a whole spiel of things that I did. And then there was somebody in the group who said, "Oh, you mean like this?" And he turned his camera around. And I went, yeah, just like that.
Aww.
The others had not seen it, but he had not only seen it, he had photographed it. And somebody else said, "Oh, I thought I saw a wisp of white, but I thought it was just my imagination." And he was like, "Right here, right here." That was pretty amazing.
That's awesome.
I think I would have felt embarrassed if I'd been looking right at it and hadn't seen it. But this guy had it on his phone. But yeah, I mean, they are just everywhere. In pagan communities, we talk about there's a veil between the world of matter and spirit. But I'm telling you here, there's not been a veil in 15 years, maybe more. It's like just the in and out and in and out.
You said in the last 15 years, do you feel like something has changed or shifted?
I think things shifted kind of at the turn of the century.
Okay.
Which I realized when I was like 24 years ago. But yeah, something happened when we got to 2000. Something shifted.
Oh, interesting.
And I think that's why there's more interest in this now. Because I think more people are, even if they're not seeing it or hearing, they're sensing the world around them is peopled in a way that they don't understand.
Talking about giving instructions, that's really a lot about what this book, Small Magics, is. It's a series of instructions on how to do different things. And I love it. You talk about everything from stretching and connecting with your body and getting prepared for what you're going to do with grounding. And then you talk about warding, you talk about shielding. You even go into some more controversial things such as Bane work and stuff of that nature. I love that you cover all the basics. You're very, very clear about all of this. It's not mired in esoterical terms. It's very easy for people to follow. You also said that this type of magic does draw a lot of its strength from the land itself. Are these ideas and these instructions that you have in the book transferable to other locations? Or do you think that there's something very specific about the mountains that makes these things work?
Oh, not at all is this book tied into my particular land. I encourage anyone who practices magic to be connected deeply to the land that they're on. My publisher decided they really wanted to tie this into my collection of Appalachian books, because I've written several of those now. With this book, you can harvest and leverage energy and do magic, period. And these are the basics that I learned 50 years ago that I don't think people are teaching anymore. Because the notion now is that you just get a really good spell book, and then you look up what your problem is, and then you say the spell, and then maybe you go out and buy a particular color candle, and you buy these herbs, and you do all that. And nothing against people who have shops, either online or brick and mortar, because they got to make a living too. But witchcraft is not about material objects. Witchcraft is harvesting and leveraging available energy with the force of your will to achieve change. That's what witchcraft is. And that's what this book is all about. When I was coming up, you had to learn the basic steps. So before you started pointing your finger and calling up a demon, which every little youngin' on TikTok apparently wants to do, before you learned that, you had to learn how to ground yourself. You had to learn how to use energy that was not your life force. You had to harvest energy from outside. So that's why we would say things like, wait until the moon is waxing, because at that point the energy is moving up, it's expanding in strength. We love to work during the part of the year when it's between the winter solstice and the summer solstice, as the sun is growing stronger and stronger and stronger, because we want the strength of that energy. But it's a matter of walking through steps and learning those steps so well that you don't have to think about it. And it should be easy. You should practice it so much that it's easy.
That is one thing that I love about this book, is how simple you lay out the steps. And I feel like so many instructional books on this sort of thing, like, just go do it. Just go shield yourself. Just go shield yourself. And it's like, but how? How do I ground? You know, how do I shield? And yeah. Love that you actually put that in there, because not everybody knows. And they need to figure it out somehow. And if they don't have a mentor or a parent or something that can walk them through it, then this book is a very, very valuable resource.
Thank you so much for that. It came out of a class I've been teaching for about 8 years called Simple Practical Magic. Uh-huh. Because I kept running into people who would go, well, I did this spell for fill in the blank, but it didn't really work for me. And I said, well, can you back up and kind of tell me what you did? Well, I read in a book that I had to have a green candle. And then I also had to have this herb and these stones. And then I had to say these words for 3 days. But they just didn't understand the basics of moving energy around. And it's not hard. The point is that magic is not hard. Years ago, a woman was putting together an anthology about women's voices in magic. And I contacted her because I wanted to do an essay talking about the difference between the curandera practices versus Appalachian healing practices, and kind of talk about it because there are a lot of similarities. And her response was, oh, that would be great. We don't have any essays on low magic. Yeah, my response was, oh, low magic. You mean the kind of magic that works magic? That magic?
Nice comeback.
Jason Miller, and y'all probably know who Jason is. He does that wonderful strategic sorcery course. He came up with the very best definition. He calls it the difference between temple magic and field magic. So temple magic, you build the beautiful altar and you pour wine to the gods and you wear your best robes and you calculate where Mercury is and you do all of that sort of what was called high magic or ceremonial magic. And that's temple magic. And then field magic is what I used to refer to as MacGyver magic. I would say, you know, it's like a MacGyver sort of magic. And people would go, oh, is that an Ulster Scots Wiccan tradition? No, oh. It's not. It's that TV show, you know, where you dig in your pocket and you go, oh, I got a paper clip and I got a nub of a pencil and I got some dust over here and I'm going to use that with some spit and do what I need to do today. Mm-hmm. So, yeah, field magic works for me because that's what it is. It's folk magic is all about using available resources and the energy around you to affect the change that is needed. And that's what this book is about. You can get any of my books through my preference is that you use an indie bookstore rather than ordering it from you-know-who.
Yes, mm-hmm. Yes.
So if you have an independent bookstore in your community, order it from there. But you can get them anywhere you normally would get books. If you order from my local indie bookstore, which is malaprops.com, they will call me and I'll go by there and sign it.
Oh, okay.
Which I do pretty often.
Mm-hmm. That's wonderful. You said that was malaprops.com?
Malaprops.com. MALAPROPS. And they are a fabulous independent bookstore.
Oh, good. Good to know.
You do also have your own website, myvillagewitch.com. And is that where people can find out about festivals that you're going to be at or contact you if they need a cleansing?
Yeah, they can if I've updated my website.
Oh, got it.
I mean, let's just be honest. The best place to find out what I'm doing right now is to follow me on Facebook because that's my primary social media.
Okay.
I'm full up in the friends department. Sorry, but you can follow me. I also have another Facebook page is H. Byron Ballard, author, Witch About Town.
Okay. I like that. Witch About Town.
And so you can follow me there.
Okay.
And I'm on Twitter and I'm on Insta, not frequently, but some.
That's a lot of places people can get a hold of you.
Yes.
You had brought up the word haints comfortably and immediately, and you're one of our very few guests that has used that word. To you, what does that word mean as opposed to using the word ghost?
Well, I guess it's cultural. So I grew up hearing the word haint, and it was always accompanied by booger. So it's haints and boogers.
Uh-huh. Yep.
And boogers are what we now call cryptids. They're ghosts and cryptids. So that's how the sort of the overculture would talk about it. But we would talk about the weird dark shape that walks from here to there, stuff like that. But that was not so prevalent as it is now, the whole cryptid and boogers thing.
So it's equivalent to the term ghosts. It's just like a Southern comfort term, like spelling country with a K, that kind of thing.
Yeah.
Becky defines haints as any ghost you'd rather not have in your house.
Oh, I like that.
I'm drawing from with that, like the low country interpretation where they would use the paint blue to keep the spirits out. So that's kind of how I define it in my mind.
I can see that. And I don't know if it's the Scots-Irish people who are comfortable with their dead people being around. I don't know, but I know in the Afro-Caribbean traditions, haints are often, they're bad folk.
Right.
You don't want them around. You don't want those kind of spirits coming in. My husband's family is Italian. It's true with the Italians, too. They're very, whoa, don't talk about that. And the Cherokee, of course, and I don't want to talk about that either.
Right.
But we are kind of painfully comfortable with it.
Yes.
I'm not exactly sure why, but it is certainly true. I just did a paper for the Appalachian Studies Association conference, and in it I talked about every family that I knew growing up. They had a family member who died but never really left the property. That's where Aunt Jenny is, or Grandpa, or whatever.
It's another question I had for you, because we have been told by some mediums that...
Not Appalachian.
Different regions. That in their experience, the presence of a spirit, whether it's a friendly spirit or a haint, will eventually wear the living to illness of some sort. And it's never good for a spirit to remain here consciously long term, even if they're having a great time interacting with the living. What's your opinion about those opinions?
Well, I guess I'm going to return to our previous conversation of my book, Small Magic, that if you get your shields up, a wandering spirit is not going to be able to take any energy from you.
I like that. Byron, this has been amazing talking to you. We've really, really enjoyed getting to know you. Is there anything that we didn't cover that you want to share with our audience?
I guess what I would like to say is that we are all creatures in this place. I'm a big animist. So if spirit beings are appearing to you, try not to be afraid, but try to think about why they are there and kind of work backwards from there. Reverse engineer what's going on and see if you can figure it out. Because it may be a message you need to hear that you're not hearing any other way.
Excellent advice.
I do like that theory that the reason some people will see a ghost and others won't is because they need that message, not necessarily that the ghost needs to say something to them.
Exactly.
Well, Painted Love, those of you listening, we have been talking to Byron Ballard, author, tarot reader, I just learned. She will also cleanse houses. You can find out all about her at myvillagewitch.com and also on her Facebook pages, which she listed earlier, and we will have in our show notes. And then you can also check out our books that are published through Llewellyn. And what was the name of the bookstore that you suggest people purchase from?
Malaprops. Malaprops.com.
Wonderful. And the book that you most recently put out is Small Magics, and it is anything but small. It is amazing, wonderful advice about getting the building blocks of magic. I really, really like how you've broken things down into very digestible, easy to follow steps. Anybody can work through this book and really gain a lot of insight into their own practice. So thank you so much, Byron, for being here. This has been great to talk to you.
Well, thank you for those kind words, and thanks for the invitation. It's been nice to put faces to the names.
Now that I'm learning so much about Appalachia and Appalachian magic and haints and boogers, it's pretty clear now why Becky chose the tagline for the first season as Everybody Has a Ghost Story. And why it took her 5 whole years to realize, well, maybe not everybody does have a ghost story. But now everybody from Appalachia has a ghost story and has a spooky day.
Homespun Haints is hosted by Becky Kielimnik and Diana Doty and produced by Homespun Haints Media, LLC. Editing and music by Becky Kielimnik. Show notes by Diana Doty. If you have a ghost story and you'd like to be considered as a guest for this podcast, please visit our website at homespunhaints.com/submit.